Welcome to the debauchery. Today we discuss one of the most tragic and controversial stories in recent memory, when in December of 2012, 20-year-old Adam Lanza murdered his mother and stole her car to drive to Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, where he murdered 6 educators and 20 students, all under the age of 7 years old. I'm Dave Jari.
I'm Garrett Quarter.
And this is Criminal as Fuck. What's good, everybody, and welcome to season 3.
Season 3. I can't believe it.
I know, it's crazy. 3 fucking years we've been doing this shit.
Isn't that nuts?
Once again, I'm Dave Jari, and with me, as always, is my co-host Garrett Quarter.
How we doing?
Just give you a heads up, I'm a little stuffy today, so.
Makes your voice sound better. It's
all right. Does it? Yeah. Makes it sound sexy.
Yeah.
Like, how's everybody doing out there? You doing good?
Sound like a real radio broadcast.
All right, we got to say what's up to our sponsor for this episode, Factor Meals. Factor helps you fuel up fast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. You'll save time, eat well, and stay on track with your healthy lifestyle. These are just a few reasons why Factor is America's #1 ready-to-eat meal delivery service. Stay tuned to learn how you can save big on your first month of Factor. We got to give a shout out to Jill Frey and Alexis Epps for becoming the newest members of our fucked up family. Thank you very much. This is actually our largest group on Patreon to date. So thank you so much for everybody supporting us. And thank you to our free members as well. Love to see everyone jumping on the calf train. Choo-choo! Before we get into all of this, we just need to remind everyone a few things about Criminal AF, okay? We're a comedic, informative, true crime podcast. We're not comedians. We'll never claim ourselves as comedians, but Criminal AF does have comedic undertones, meaning we like to have some fun when telling these stories. Sometimes we find things are particularly funny given the situation, and sometimes we like to take a big heaping shit on some of these murderers out there.
Yeah, I love how you're giving everybody out there a forewarning, like, hey, we're not going to take this serious.
Right. So, you know, we like to beat up on the murderers out there because, let's face it, they're scum and fuck their feelings, right?
Yeah.
Who cares?
For sure.
All right, with that being said, we do discuss some pretty horrific and tragic stories. We will not shy away from the most gruesome of details, regardless of how disgusting they may be. Now, we understand that Criminal AF is not for everyone, and, you know, that's okay. We just ask that you at least give it a listen, and if it's not for you, hey, thanks for checking it out.
See ya.
But if it is, welcome to the debauchery. Now, head on over to criminalasfuck.com for all of your Criminal AF needs. Check out our episodes, videos, reviews, send us messages for mail call and dear douchebags, as well as join our Patreon. For an ad-free experience, just sign up for $2 a month, which is less than one Dunkin' Donuts coffee, which I just paid $3.64 for this one, which is a fucking travesty. And don't even get me started on Starbucks, but $5
member. Oh, you mean the goat?
The goat, yeah, right. I'll have a small. What's a small?
It's a tall.
A small is a tall.
A small is a tall.
And a grande.
A grande is a medium. And a venti is a large. It's not that hard, guys.
Shut the fuck up.
I hate.
Yeah. Can I have a venti butt?
Fucking boomer.
Yeah. Can I have a venti butt fuck chuckaluck with mocha frap shit? I don't even fucking know. We went to Starbucks the other day. I'm like, I'm not even ordering. I'm like, you just fucking yell at the window. I don't even know.
I'd like a venti low-fat skim milk.
Yeah, can I have a...
Positive shaken, not stirred.
Pine tar. Fucking... I'm like, what are you talking about? Just give me a fucking coffee.
A cinnamon dolce.
Yeah. All right, back to this. All right, so a $5 membership for our Patreon gets you access to all of our bonus content. We've been adding some episodes of a new segment we call is YouTube and Chill, where we chill along together with videos off of YouTube and discuss some, you know, additional pertinent information related to the stories. So far, it's been a pretty big hit. So stay tuned for more episodes of YouTube and Chill exclusively on Patreon.
Exclusively.
Yeah, you're not going to get it anywhere else. You're not going to get it anywhere else. Also, while you're visiting criminalasfuck.com, go check out our merch.
Go get you some merch.
Yes, sir. We're adding new styles and designs all the time, and we're even branching out to more stuff other than just Criminal AF gear. So go check that out on our website or by going directly to criminalafshop.com. You can also go visit all of our friends over at welcometothedebauchery.com, where you can find a plethora of independent podcasts joining together to create one beautiful podcast world. Finally, if there's one thing that we ask of you is that you go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Good Pods and leave us a 5-star rating, a positive review, and click that share button. Let your family and friends know who we are. It costs you absolutely nothing. It will help us immensely in spreading the word that Criminal AF is
the number one true crime podcast in the world. World.
All right, Dave.
Yeah.
I think it's time to go to Florida. All right, this one's a little heavy today.
Oof.
Tampa murder suspect accused of trying to romance his teen daughter before shooting spree, prosecutors say.
Oh.
Holy shit.
Jesus.
Tampa, I mean, it's kind of fitting for today's episode.
Oh, Tampa.
Tampa, Florida.
Yeah.
Prosecutors claim they know why a Tampa man flew into a murderous rage Wednesday afternoon and want to keep him behind bars.
Ooh, suspense. What's the reason?
On Wednesday, Tampa police say Michael Banks shot and killed one woman and injured two others, including a juvenile girl, before opening fire on responding officers at his home on North 23rd Street. Police say Banks was taken into custody after they returned fire and he surrendered. In a pretrial...
Oh, they didn't kill him?
No, they didn't kill him. Surprisingly. Hey, he probably gave up once the bullets started coming like a pussy.
Mm.
Didn't have the balls to go out there.
Should have ate one himself.
In a pretrial detention motion filed by prosecutors, they say Banks flew into a violent rage after he overheard his mother and another woman discussing kicking Banks out of the family home after it was revealed Banks was pursuing a romantic relationship with his daughter. Prosecutors say Prosecutors say Banks was feeling angry and betrayed.
How dare you? How dare you question me about wanting to fuck my daughter?
Oh, dude, even when you say it, it sounds fucking horrible.
Ugh.
So he grabbed a loaded revolver and shot and killed an unidentified woman.
I challenge you to a duel.
Dude, the like egotistical maniac he is to be like, how dare they kick me out of the house to go and shoot somebody?
You're questioning me?
After they just found out that you are trying to pursue a relationship with his own kid? No. Then, according to prosecutors, he shot at his mother and a bullet grazed her head. So he shoots the unidentified female.
Kills her. Okay.
Then shoots at his own mom.
Grazes her head.
According to the documents filed by prosecutors, Banks then went after a 17-year-old daughter, who he was claiming he was in love with. That's strange. Who was taking a shower. They claimed Banks fired through the bathroom door and struck the teen in the leg.
I wonder if it's like, if I can't have you, nobody can have you.
Yeah, I can see that.
Like, I just killed this lady.
We see it all the time.
I shot at my mom. Now I'm going to get fucking arrested.
Yep.
And, like, if I can't be with you, then nobody...
Well, when we get down, you can actually see that he was very... They say Banks' daughter and his mother ran out of the house screaming for help. When Banks was questioned by police, they said he confirmed he had written a love letter to his daughter, urging her enter into a relationship with him and not to date anyone else.
What?
So exactly like you said,
dude.
Exactly like you said, he probably was like, if I can't have you, no one's gonna have me.
So, well, I mean, the story's not done yet, but I mean, did he just like talk about these feelings with her, or did like you gotta ask, like, was he fucking like molesting her?
Well, something was going on enough so that the mother and the unidentified female.
Oh, we're actually talking. He overheard the conversation
about you better kick that motherfucker out of the house. And that's what started the violent shooting spree.
Oh, my God.
So something had to have been going on enough
that
for.
That poor girl.
At 17.
Ugh.
Going through all that.
Ugh. All right. Where were we? I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Into the relationship with him and nobody else. So, yes, you were right about that, by the way. Because obviously, right there, he was upset with her dating.
Right.
Banks has a violent criminal history that includes a conviction on an aggravated battery charges from beating a pregnant woman in 2007.
What the fuck?
So he's already a violent felon.
A fucking piece of shit.
Now, I was doing the math earlier. So he was arrested in 2007, right?
Yeah.
And then now today, his daughter's 17.
What's the math? I don't do math.
It's close enough to be...
Was that the mother?
So he was already beating up the baby moms. It doesn't say that, but I'm doing the math in my head, and I'm pretty sure.
What is that math? Hold on.
17.
We're going to work that math real quick. People at home are like, you guys are fucking idiots. All
right. 2007.
2024
just
minus 2007.
I had 17 years in 2007.
Oops, hold on. Yep, 17. 17.
Yeah, I figured it was close enough. So I would say that was probably his mother. They just aren't including that.
Wow. You know what? This is why I could never be a cop.
Or her mother, sorry.
I could never be a cop. Ever, ever, ever. For one, I don't have the patience. The amount of
shit these cops would put up with,
for one, just in general, like, I would lose my shit.
And that's if you. That's if most of their calls, too, is domestic violence calls.
Yeah, and if I came across this piece of shit like here, like, I would not be able to restrain myself.
Yeah, you would. You would
like, if you're like, I give up. No, fuck you. Bah!
You'd be on the news within the first year.
I didn't hear him give up.
As soon as you, like, get out of your, like, little probation area where you don't have somebody over your shoulder the 24-7, Dave, you wouldn't.
I wouldn't last. I'm telling you right now. I'll be honest with you, too. I do not have the patience
Some girl's getting late to work. You pull her over. She's just like, fucking piece of shit. Yeah. I'm going to be late for work.
Yeah. Like, there's some videos where they're like, you know, can you please step out of the car? No, I don't have to. You kind of have to do. No, I don't have to. Dude, I'd smash the fucking window, rip them out.
You have a deep
take the
darkness.
Butt end of my pistol and just fucking bash it.
You
fucking
have a
head
deep
in.
Darkness in you. And the funny part is even the people that listen to the podcast understand, like, oh, there's something there with Dave.
No.
Imagine if you knew him in person, guys.
It's all good fun.
You hear the unfiltered story. But I will say, I don't think, you wouldn't last. You would be on the news.
Yeah.
Eventually. You would be a headline.
Yeah,
for sure.
Somewhere along the line. It'd be some, like, fucking guy, like, guy Karen.
I
wouldn't do it to a woman Karen.
Yeah, of course.
But if it was, like, a guy Karen, I'd be like, you're a little fucking bitch. Get the fuck out of the car.
Gun. So Banks has a violent criminal history that includes a conviction of aggravated battery charges for beating a pregnant woman in 2007.
Yeah.
Banks is being held without bond until he is at pretrial detention hearing next Wednesday at 3 p.m.
Yeah. So this is like.
So let's just hope this motherfucker stays in jail for the rest of his life because he's already.
This is just the other day, right?
Look at him. Michael Banks.
That actually looks like somebody we work with. I'm not going to name names.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I know exactly. I know exactly what you're talking about.
That's 100% somebody we work with. anyway.
That poor 17-year-old girl who has to go through that kind of trauma in her life.
What? Okay. Why is she with him? Like, where's the... I have a lot of questions.
We've talked about it on this show.
Yeah, this dude beats up his pregnant wife. So obviously he's a felon or whatever. And he has custody of his teenage daughter, who he's trying to fucking date, which I would give a 99% chance that he's already fucking molesting.
Yeah. Now, well, here's the thing, too, it was the family home. So the mother owned the home.
His mother.
Yes, you can tell. They don't say that, but it's... the mother, it was overheard with his mother and another woman discussing kicking Banks out of the family home. So it was the mother's home. So it could have been those situations like you said, the grandma takes the kid in and removes them, quote unquote, from a bad situation. And then now he has nowhere to go. So he stays, comes and moves back into the grandma's home.
Right.
And then they might as well be living together.
Like the Keep It in the Family episode.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've talked about it countless times. DCF
what's his name? Stephen Plato?
As much good as DCF does, they miss a lot of shit, too. So
there's
like
a lot of fucking red tape. Like, I know people who have worked for it. There is a lot of fucking red tape.
It's very hard to take a kid away from their parents. But now I can kind of see that the grandma probably had custody of that child. He was probably
A boarder. He just
Like, hey, grandma, mom, I gotta come back up.
I don't have a place to live.
Yeah.
My job at Radio Shack. Fucking
Radio Shack. You work at Radio Shack in 2023?
No, this is 2024.
Oh, 2024.
Last week.
Still not even used to saying it.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
Yeah, that was a fucking trip. I hope he fucking dies. I'm not even kidding. Like, I hope somebody fucking shanks him in jail. I'm not kidding. Dude's a piece of shit. Beats a pregnant woman and then fucking molests his fucking daughter. So, fuck him. Criminal AF will be back after this quick break. Get started on your resolutions with Factor, so you're ready in the new year. Factor's ready-to-eat meal delivery takes the stress out of meal planning and sets you up for success in the new year. Skip the grocery stores, prep work, and cooking fatigue. Instead, get chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. With over 35 meals to choose per week, including options like keto, calorie smart, vegan and veggie, and more, plus over 55 weekly add-ons, you'll have a ton of nutritious and flavorful options to kickstart your resolutions. Factor now offers loads of snack options like breakfast, smoothies, juices, snacks, and more to keep you going no matter what's on the schedule.
When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. Change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause or reschedule your deliveries at any time.
Functional.
Super functional.
Like for me personally, I said it before, I'll say it again. That Indian butter chicken, bro.
It's good.
I'm telling you. I could eat that every single day. I would live the rest of my life on Indian butter chicken.
Mine's the vegan chili.
The vegan chili. Like, it's come to the point where now even my son is, like, digging into my Factor meals.
Oh, yeah, he's stealing them out of your fridge. Yeah.
I'm like, bro, get your own subscription.
Yeah, my kid likes them, too, which is crazy. Factor always comes in clutch with me whenever I'm going on my four-day work week. Most of the time, if you have a significant other who works different schedules, I work nights, my wife works days. It's so easy when I sleep because she gets home, I wake up, I have to go right to work. I have to go to work to get that extra 2 hours of sleep. I don't care what anyone says. And just be able to, instead of getting up early, having to meal prep or make my dinner before work, to just grab one of those Factor meals, knowing I'm going to get all the goodness from a real home cooked meal. It's the easiest solution. It's not rocket science here.
Pop it in the microwave for 2 minutes and you're good to go. It's
delicious too.
So to get your Indian butter chicken or get an extra 2 hours of sleep, head on over to factormeals.com/criminalaf50 and use code criminalaf50 to get 50% off your first box.
That's factormeals.com/criminalaf50 and use code criminalaf50 to get 50% off.
Factor,
America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service.
Now back to Criminal AF.
All right, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Here we go. All right. Are you sure?
Yeah, let's get it.
All right. In this episode, we'll be discussing the tragic 2012 school shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. An episode that Garrett and I have discussed for quite a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, we put it off each time. We're like, we're not ready. We're not ready.
Yep.
So, here it is. So, settle in, pour your favorite drink, grab some snacks. Tell your Uncle Steve there's no time to play hide the salami, because it's time
Uncle Steve salami.
This episode in the mouth. You don't have an Uncle Steve?
No, I don't have an Uncle Steve.
All right.
And I definitely don't want to see a salami.
All right. Take a deep breath. Here we go. All right. We're going to start this episode off all the way back in June of 1981, when Peter Lanza married Nancy Jean Champion, or Beanie, as she was called by her friends and family. The couple settled in Nancy's hometown in Kingston, New Hampshire, on property located on part of her family's land. Peter and Nancy were both going to college, and it was decided at the time that they would both place their futures on Peter's career. So in 1988, when their first son Ryan was born, Nancy focused solely on raising Ryan, while Peter put everything he had into his career to provide for their soon-to-be growing family. In 1992, the Lanzas had their second son, Adam.
Ooh, you can feel the fucking...
The history.
The tension.
The timeline.
Yeah. Adam. It just sounds...
Here's a timeline starting, yeah. So, Nancy doted excessively on her children, and it became apparent relatively early that Adam was experiencing some developmental issues. By the age of 3, Adam had trouble communicating with his parents, brothers, counselors, and psychiatrists. He wasn't able to form words, so he would come off as babbling.
You know, in present time, we all know that now is right. Nonverbal autism. Like, if you're nonverbal autistic, but back then they were like, he's babbling. You know,
he's late, developing late.
Yeah.
He's a late bloomer.
You heard that a lot back in the 90s.
Yeah. He's late bloomer. Yeah. So as a result, Lanza would hit, spit, and cry when he could not make his needs known, according to a 1995 speech evaluation. He would start exhibiting other issues during this time, such as a strong sensitivity to smell or smells that weren't existent, hated to be touched, and would do repetitive behaviors such as hitting his head against a wall.
All signs
of autism. That we know now, but back then?
Yeah.
Totally different. Lanza was diagnosed as having sensory integration disorder, a condition in which the brain has trouble receiving and responding to the senses. Extremes on both ends of the spectrum may be present. Some people with this disorder may be hypersensitive to sounds, touch, or taste, while others are unresponsive to anything around them, such as they don't feel pain or are oblivious to extreme hot and cold conditions. So they'll like touch a fucking burning stove and
just hold their hand.
Whatever.
There.
Yeah, they don't feel it.
Now, when you worked with people on the spectrum in your old job, did you have any kids with sensory problems?
Yes and no.
No headphone wearers?
There was one that wore headphones. they're sensitive to sound, where another one, like if you sounded excited, or if you made like, you know, whoa, hey, you know, like they would get excited too. And they would like get all fucking happy and shit. You know what I mean? So it's like you had to balance it. Like if they were both in the same room, you had to kind of like balance between being, you know, loud and excited and kind of like, you know, softer. But it should be noted here that sensory integration disorder is no longer a standalone diagnosis. It is now associated as one of the many disorders that are characteristic of autism. There is little else known about Adam from his preschool years to about first grade, other than Adam was placed on an IEP, which is an individual educational plan, or some places call it a 504 plan. They're basically the same thing. I'm familiar with an IEP as someone close to me was placed on one when they were in school. The IEP can consist of a number of tools or assistance in order to help the child stay on par with the rest of the class. The IEP that I'm familiar with was for someone who is ADHD. They were given extra time to take tests, or they could actually retake their test if they decided to. Extra time was given for reading with scheduled breaks. So instead of being like, oh, read chapters 1 through 5, they would be allowed to read chapter 1 and then we'll discuss. Read chapter 2, we'll discuss. Yeah. They were also given a desk where it could be used either sitting in a chair or standing up. You know, because a lot of kids with ADHD, they get antsy just sitting there for hours on end.
Listen to a full hour.
Right.
Lecture.
Yep. So it's like, okay, you can stand, but you have to stay at your desk, you know, no wandering around, whatever. Now
IEPs, you get pairs usually with those too, correct?
Depending on the scale.
Yeah.
Like if you're required to have like a one-on-one, you know, like with reading, you know, while the class is doing like a reading section or whatever, if you require the reading of the chapter, then discussing the chapter back and forth, then yeah, you would get a one-on-one. Now, Nancy had entered both boys into extracurricular activities such as Cub Scouts, and Adam's disdain for being in groups or being touched became apparent. He would scream and become angry if he was touched, even in the slightest of ways, such as a, you know, hey, good job, pat on the back, you know, whatever, or a high five or a handshake. He would just, you know,
tense up.
Yeah, don't touch me. Yeah. So in 1998, Peter Lanza was offered a lucrative job with General Electric, based out of Stanford, Connecticut. Peter wants to accept the job, but that would require moving the family over 200 miles away and leaving the comfort and stability of living on Nancy's family's compound. This was an especially difficult decision because it meant uprooting Adam and his brother Ryan from their schools and the stability that they have grown to know. However, after reviewing the schools in the area and seeing that they appeared to be better suited to Adam's needs, Nancy agreed to move.
Which is true, because we all know about Western Connecticut schools are considered some of the best schools in the country.
That's where all the money is.
Yeah.
That's where all the fucking
money is. For people that aren't familiar, where this happened, it's closer to the New York City side of Connecticut.
Yeah, it's on the lower west corner of Connecticut.
So a lot of people that work in the city buy houses out there.
Yeah.
So they can have the house and live normal lives and still commute to the city every day.
Yeah. So there's normal non-city lives.
But there are tremendous schools out there. Tremendous.
Yeah. All right. So another deciding factor of the move is that Peter and Nancy's marriage was on shaky ground, and in order to try and salvage what they had, a change of scenery was thought to be a blessing in disguise. In June of 1998, the family settled into a million-dollar home in a small neighborhood in Newtown, Connecticut called Sandy Hook. That fall, both Ryan and Adam Lanza were enrolled in Sandy Hook Elementary School. Lanza appeared to flourish while at Sandy Hook. His speech improved drastically. He seemed to be making friends, although he was still described as shy and withdrawn, and he was still hypersensitive to sounds and touch. But other than that, he seemed to be thriving, right?
Yep.
So Nancy sends a message to a friend back in New Hampshire in March of 1999, less than a year of moving to Connecticut, talking about how both Ryan and Adam's birthdays were approaching. She states that Ryan is having an old friend and a new friend party, while Adam is just having a new friend party. He now has 26 new friends, so basically invited everybody in the class.
Yeah.
Adam seems to be doing very well here and enjoys the new school. So it just goes to show how well he is adapting to Sandy Hook Elementary School and how well the staff and teachers are working with him and you know, incorporating. Like, during this time, he's doing really well. So, which makes what happens in 2012 much more harder to contemplate, meaning that throughout his entire school career, Sandy Hook Elementary was his happiest and most productive time.
Yeah.
You know, There was one red flag, I guess you could say, in hindsight, that occurred while Adam was in fifth grade at Sandy Hook Elementary School. He and a friend wrote and illustrated a book called The Big Book of Granny for a class project, but never ended up handing it in. And although they never did hand it in, it was well known throughout the school, as Peter, his father, stated that Adam was trying to sell the book to other students. It's unclear whose idea it was or who contributed more to it, but it had both Adam's and his friend's name as the authors. The title alone seems harmless enough, but when you begin to read it, it turns very dark. The book consisted of several sections, ranging from grandma jokes to granny action figures. Then you get to the adventures of Granny. There are 8 chapters of Adventures of Granny. Now, what I'm about to read is all from the official report filed after the murders. Okay? In the first chapter, called Granny's Clubhouse of Happy Children, it's an imaginary television show that had Granny, along with her son, Bobalicious, rob a bank while Granny shoots the people inside with her cane gun. It's like she carries a cane and uses it as a rifle.
Yeah.
They leave and blow up the bank with dynamite. Then Bobalicious grabs a shotgun and shoots Granny in the head. These kids are in fifth grade. Okay. The second chapter has Granny and Bobalicious out on a boat, and Granny falls in. Bobalicious throws Granny a cement flotation device, and Granny sinks and drowns. In chapter 3, Granny and Bobalicious try to kidnap a boy to stuff him and place him on the mantle, like taxidermy. Granny kicks the boy in the fireplace, and it begins to burn. The boy manages to jump out of the fire, and Granny punches him in the face. Granny throws a Granny action figure, and while the boy is distracted, the action figure comes alive and shoots the boy in the face. And Bobalicious yells, "Yay! Now we can hang him!" Chapter 4 has Granny and Bobalicious going to a hockey game, where Granny goes onto the ice and shoots a hockey player with her cane gun. Then they go out to eat.
Just like that.
Yeah. Hey, you want McDonald's? In chapter 5, Granny goes to a boot camp as a Marine and meets up with Dora the Berserker and Swiper the Raccoon. Granny asks Dora to kill a soldier, to which Dora replies, "I like hurting people, especially children."
Ooh, that's a eerie yeah. foreshadow.
Mm-hmm. And then Granny shoots multiple people at boot camp with her cane gun. Chapter 6 has Granny and Bobalicious being picked up by Dora the Berserker and Swiper the Raccoon. Dora tells Granny that they can go wherever they want, and Granny wants to go to a daycare center.
Ugh.
When they arrive, Dora sends Swiper inside to distract the children, and Dora yells, "Let's hurt the children!" In Chapter 7, Granny and Bobalicious once again go to visit Dora the Berserker. Dora takes them on an adventure to find Drunk. In the adventure, they come across a rooster and have to call upon their backpack to retrieve a gun.
Backpack, backpack. Yeah. You're the thing that's loaded up with things and knickknacks, too. Anywhere that you might go, I got inside for you.
There you go.
Backpack, backpack.
Inside the backpack, they have a handgun, AK-47, M16, a rocket launcher, and a shotgun. Dora grabs the shotgun and kills the rooster and Swiper the Raccoon. Later, she also kills her monkey named Shoes, Lenny the Cow, and Tico the Chipmunk. She's then arrested for the murders and possessions of the guns. And finally, in Chapter 8, Granny and Bobalicious build a time machine and go back in time to meet the Beatles. Granny kills all of the members of the Beatles and says, "I kill every bug I see." Granny and Bobalicious then get arrested and spend 75 years in jail. This is all from a fifth grader.
Yeah, it was, from my understanding, it was very detailed, too. It wasn't just like a...
Right.
It wasn't just like a kid's in fifth grade's drawings on a picture, like a flip book almost.
Right.
It was a detailed story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like...
That's a synopsis of what the actual...
Yeah. So, I mean, what would you do if this was your kid writing this?
There is in when I kind of read through it, the actual book too, like the portion of it. When I look at it, a lot of it has the aspects of just 5-year-old boys being fifth graders being fifth graders.
Yeah.
They say wild shit too, but then there's always a level of extreme that it goes.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much,
like a kid burning in the fire.
I don't know how much, you know, you can almost tell like when Adam took over in the stories. That's the creepy. His friend, because you know he was co-written,
right?
So a lot of it you can say, okay, was this the normal stuff that you're like, oh, that's just a fifth grade boy?
Yeah.
And then when it gets real dark out of nowhere, you're like, okay, was this Adam that took over and was like, no, this is gonna happen now?
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I would definitely like get help. Yeah. I would definitely get help. He would go see like but there and I, that this isn't the book is not the only thing that was going on. You know what I mean? The kid clearly had some sort of issues.
Oh, he was yeah. But we'll go into a little bit more about it.
Well, yeah,
well, yeah, he definitely had an interest in the macabre and the like violence and whatnot. Yeah, so apparently this wasn't a big deal at the time. Like I said, the parents knew he was trying to sell a book to the other kids in school, which means the teachers must have known about it as well. You know, if it was like this whole big thing that they were trying to promote as fifth graders. All right, back to the story. All right, so once Adam made it to middle school, I believe in the sixth grade, is when he was officially diagnosed with Asperger's. Okay, Asperger's is no longer a standalone diagnosis. It is now included in the spectrum of autism. Back in the early 2000s, the difference between Asperger's and autism was that Asperger's had similar characteristics to autism, but that Asperger's had a higher functional vocabulary.
The stereotype was that kids with Asperger's were extremely
quirky.
They didn't have the social skills that normal people did, but they were incredibly smart. They could live on their own. It wasn't a form of autism.
Yeah, no, not where, back then, yeah.
Yeah, and it was
his own thing.
You're social. I would just say you're social. You can't pick up on social cues more than
right.
I have a cousin that was diagnosed Asperger's. Yeah, and now he is in the Air Force flying fighter jets.
Oh, jeez.
Yes, but incredibly smart. You know what I mean? And then super compulsive, and about one thing, he loved planes.
Yeah.
And he was obsessed to the point where he's now flying fighter jets for the U.S. Army. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So
you get very compulsive about a certain subject too with that diagnosis.
Well, as we can see here.
Yeah.
The reason Asperger's is no longer its own diagnosis, there's actually two reasons. One is because doctors wanted to remove the misconception that Asperger's is different from autism. And the second is a bit more sinister. Hans Asperger, the man associating with discovering the condition, was a Nazi doctor and helped murder thousands of children with disabilities in the extermination camps under the Third Reich in World War II. So, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Asperger's was curb stomped in 2013. So now all autistic persons receive a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, or ASD.
Yep.
So now Adam is in the sixth grade. He's diagnosed with Asperger's, and things start to dramatically go downhill. If we all remember middle school, it was like you're now in the big kid classes. You know, like you're no longer staying in the same classroom with your classmates. You're now moving from class to class, you know, like science class, English class.
You know. Yeah, I always get into debates with that too, with other people about how people are like, oh, high school is where what determines how you're gonna be or who you're gonna like the person you're gonna become. I don't believe that. I think middle school has so much more of a like if your kid starts messing up in middle school, if they start picking those wrong friend groups in middle school, it's where it's gonna go south.
Yeah.
High school just compounds it.
Right. They say that what is it? I think it's actually younger now, but there was a saying that you raise your children till the age of 10. After that, society raises them. So you have within those 10 years to develop a moral compass and
just have some sort of morals before you set it on the world.
Because if they don't by that point and they go into like middle school and stuff, it's game over. You know what I mean? But yeah, I think especially with technology and everything nowadays, it's much earlier. I would say 8. You know, if you don't have a good grasp on, you know, if your child doesn't have a good grasp on
reality,
good luck. So now that, you know, he's in middle school, like these moments in between classes get very loud, very crowded.
Oh, yeah.
Which Adam could not adapt to. You know, kids screaming and yelling throughout the hallways. They're bumping into each other. Like, this was a no-go. Like,
bullying, too, is the worst.
Oh,
middle school is the absolute worst.
Right. Now, throughout this entire story and you know, I couldn't find any specific acts of bullying.
Yeah.
But his teachers, his parents, they all say that he acted in a way where he was bullied.
I mean, he has to. He had tics. He had everything. Yeah. You know, I mean, anybody who's been to middle school can understand that he was easy pickings for those kids.
And they would say later on that he actually had a fear.
I mean, just being an IEP alone. I mean, I remember kids getting torn apart because, like, they had, you know, paras and shit.
Special ed kids.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Kids are awful.
Yeah, especially the middle school kids.
Yeah, middle school,
they're fucking brutal. Yeah. At least when you're, like, high school, you know, you almost become, like, not, I don't, that's a bad word, I want to say, you don't pity them, but you know what I'm saying? Like, you don't bully
you become,
the special needs kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You're
friendly. Like
by that age, you have like an acceptance of
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But middle school is brutal. It's brutal. They're like little fucking
little minions.
Minions just trying to like overstep each other and right. try to outdo each other and trying to show off.
One up and
yeah. So it's like, oh, who can say the most fucked up thing to the slow kid in class? Yeah. It's horrible.
I used to coach youth football, the sixth or eighth grades. Let me tell you.
Brutal.
Yeah. I'm like, where are your fucking parents? Like, what are you, like, you are out of fucking control. Like, all of them. It's just like, well, not, I can't say all of them. There were some good kids, but you can just see, because I did it for about, 6 or 7 years. And just over that period, you could see how out of control the kids were getting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was bad. Anyway, all right, back to the story. Speaking of ADHD, this is what we do.
Yeah. Both of us diagnosed, by the way. Diagnosed ADHD.
And we're doing this in the morning, so neither of us have had our medication yet. So anyway, so Adam's IEP has changed, and he is now allowed to half homeschool and half go to school. Okay. Let me explain. He was still under the tutelage of Newtown Public Schools. Okay. So he wasn't homeschooled, so to speak. He was still being sent assignments and all that kind of stuff. But he was able to do most of his schoolwork at home. While a time when he was required to be in school, he would go when there are no other students there, whether it was before school, after school, whatever.
Yep.
So he was no longer required to be in school while school was in session. Adam also became increasingly withdrawn during this time, removing himself from activities he once enjoyed, like Boy Scouts, and even went as far as no longer celebrating holidays, including his birthday. He wanted nothing to do with it. Adam was removed from middle school at this time and placed in a private school called St. Rose of Lima in Newtown. He was only there for one term due to his continued writing of violent and graphic stories,
God.
Which is heavily frowned upon in parochial schools. Right? One teacher at St. Rose's later said, "I remember giving creative writing assignments to students, instructing them to write one or two pages on whatever they wanted to talk about. Right? Just give me a page.
Yep.
That's all." Adam wrote 10 pages obsessing about battles, destruction, and war. I have known seventh grade boys to talk about things like this, but Adam's level of violence was disturbing.
Yeah, back to what I was saying earlier. Yeah. There's like, when does it go, the escalation? You can tell when a seventh grader writes. Yeah. Seventh grade, like we were just saying, they're nuts. Yeah.
But there's levels
to this shit.
Adam's creative writing was so graphic, it could not be shared. So after Adam's short stint at St. Rose's, he was enrolled back into public school in the middle school. But after just a few days, Adam hadn't slept or even eaten. So he was brought to the hospital and was again diagnosed with Asperger's by a Dr. Paul Fox.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for the same.
Yeah. Thanks for reiterating. Dr. Fox would go on to say that there was no school environment that was suitable for Adam and gave a recommendation that Adam be homeschooled permanently.
That's so sad. That's a failure right there, because I don't think locking a kid up
I know where we're going with this.
It's, you know what I mean? Like right there.
Well, later on, I'm going to bring up all the fucking red flags that were missed.
Yeah. That this poor kid just didn't have a shot. And I mean, he might not have ever had a shot, but at least being around social settings, changing his fucking his setting could have did something.
Yep. So this is when Adam begins to spiral. He becomes extremely secluded. He blocks out all sunlight from his room.
Yep.
And his only interactions with the outside world is his periodic attendance at the school tech club and through online chats while playing World of Warcraft. His OCD begins to escalate as well. He begins demanding that his laundry be washed every hour, and he changes his clothes continuously throughout the day and night, particularly his socks, changing them more than 20 times a day. He washes his hands so often to the point his skin begins peeling off. For his eighth grade graduation, his homeschool graduation, and probably an attempt to get Adam to become more active rather than isolating in his room, Peter and Nancy buy him the home version of a game called Dance Dance Revolution, a game that he would become obsessed with. Over the next several years, Adam would get dropped off at a local movie theater and play the arcade version of Dance Dance Revolution for up to 10 hours every weekend day. Every opportunity he got. Drive me to the arcade.
Coming from someone who's played DDR yeah. at home, had yeah. that at home dance pad and stuff like yeah. that. When if Dude, you I get good
do,
at
I
it,
I can't even do a minute of it. Never mind.
If you get hours. Good at it, it's actually impressive.
Yeah.
The level of actual athleticism you need yeah. to be good at that
well,
game.
Well, there was, I've never played it before. I mean, quote unquote, I've played it, but I haven't like played it. You yeah. know what I mean? Like, oh, let me try it. You know,
yeah,
kind
of you're at the arcade, you step on it, you're yeah. like, all right, this is stupid.
Yeah, yeah. So, but there's videos out there of him doing this.
Yeah.
And he's playing two player.
Like, yeah, two mats at the same time.
Two mats at the same time. Yeah. It's like fucking wild. You know? I mean, I'm not trying to praise him at his DDR skills, but, you know, it's
interesting too that his OCD was that bad at this point, and yeah. it got worse
it
as he
young,
got older.
Middle school. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, autism, OCD, he has every neurological
yep.
disorder you can think of at the mm-hmm. and up to the point of when the tragedy happened. It's interesting how usually that kind of stuff doesn't happen until you're adolescent or like 16, 17.
Yeah.
You mean you hear stories about schizophrenia and all that stuff later on in your life. It yeah. seemed like it was every year something else would come up with him.
Like, yeah, it just started like cascading.
Yeah.
Like diagnosis. But we will learn that not much was actually diagnosed. So... All right, so in 2006, Adam decides he would like to try to go back to school, this time at Newtown High School. This is believed to be the result of the relationship Adam had built with the teacher in charge of the tech club, Richard Novia. According to Novia, he identified Adam as someone who was being bullied based on his behaviors he had witnessed when Adam first attended the tech club back in eighth grade. Novia went out of his way to build trust with Adam, and over time, the two became very close. While Adam still struggled immensely with the day-to-day interactions with being in school, crowded hallways, loud environments, etc., he looked forward to his time in tech club. He even had a strong IEP that allowed him to succeed academically. Right? They had very structured learning environments for him in school.
Well, I mean, he wasn't a dumb kid by any means. He was very smart in the aspect of like even writing, like mm-hmm. creative writing. Yeah. Even though it was dark, he could crank out a 10-page essay like it was nothing.
Right. So with Adam appearing to once again thrive, even appearing in a tech club photo for the yearbook, something he would never have done prior, Richard Novia moved on to other pursuits in 2008. Adam had a difficult time adjusting to Novia's departure, and not long after, Nancy made the decision to remove him from Newtown High School. He began taking classes at Western Connecticut State University, but that too was short-lived. This was the beginning of what led Adam Lanza to the front door of Sandy Hook Elementary School 4 years later. His life would now be an ever-escalating transition of instability. He would fall deeper and deeper into a world only he belonged to and would cut out the rest from entering. He no longer had Mr. Novia, no longer had the amazing support network of his teachers and counselors at Newtown High School, no longer had any reason to walk out of the front door of his house, which would soon turn into his dark and dank dungeon.
Oof.
Criminal AF would be back after this quick break. Now back to Criminal AF. Another blow would occur in 2009 when his father, Peter, filed for divorce. Although the split was amicable, with Peter agreeing to pay Nancy $240,000 a year for alimony and child support.
Wow, how much was he making?
I believe his annual salary was upwards towards $600,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Adam separated himself from his father and soon would never speak to him or see him again.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's kind of important to note that even though their divorce was filed and granted in 2009, Peter had been out of the house, by most accounts, by 2001, less than 3 years after the family moved from New Hampshire to Connecticut. As we just said before, one of the reasons Nancy agreed to move was to salvage their already shattered marriage. The boys didn't really notice anything out of the ordinary during all this time because it was customary that they didn't see Peter during the work week anyway due to his travel to Stanford for, you know, his job. So seeing him only on the weekends didn't really seem odd at all. You know, so there wasn't really, they weren't like missing him, but just the blow of, all right, we're divorced, we're done, you know, kind of thing was like a moment for him, I guess you could say. In 2010, Nancy, who was raised in New Hampshire around guns and already owned a couple of her own, decided to purchase a few more and take up target shooting again as a hobby. And even though Adam had shown violent tendencies and an obsession with violence since at least the fifth grade, she brought Adam along and at times Ryan to go shooting with her.
I mean,
I can almost, I can kind of see like her thinking, like, I got to get this kid out of the house. How can I get him out of the house? Oh, he plays fucking RPG games, what are they called?
Shoot, FPSs, first-person shooters. He plays shooters game. I can, yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's like the Dahmer's dad. You know what I mean? Like, you're just trying to show some sort of fucking interest in something that your kid likes. Or try to be included.
Let's do taxidermy on fucking.
Now, granted, maybe bringing the kid who's obsessed with killing and guns and violence, not shooting. I don't know.
But we'll actually go more into how she viewed this a little bit later in the episode. Now, according to Nancy, this was something that Adam really, really took to. And she commented how responsible he was with handling guns. That's because the dude was probably like mesmerized. Like,
yeah.
Wow. Oh my God, a real one. You know, by late 2010, his brother had got a job in New York City and moved to Hoboken, New Jersey. Ryan and Adam never really saw eye to eye to begin with. So this was a good enough reason for Adam to never speak to Ryan again. So 2009, he broke off all communication with his father. 2010, he broke off all communication with his brother. By 2012, Nancy had 5 guns registered to her: a 22 LR Savage Mark II bolt action rifle,
L22,
a Sega 12, which is a 12 gauge shotgun.
That's a Sega 12 is a fully automatic, not fully automatic, but it's semi-automatic shotgun. Yeah.
Two handguns: a Glock 20 SF and a Sig Sauer P226, and finally a Bushmaster XM15. Lanza did have glimmers of doing something with his life at this point. He wanted to join the army, but that quickly fizzled out. Then he wanted to be a cop like his uncle in New Hampshire, but Nancy was like, yeah, you're probably not going to be a cop. So she kind of scores that.
Yeah, I don't think he would have made it past selection anyway.
Yeah. He had his eyes set on going to college once again, but that never came to fruition. So once Adam reached the age of 18, Nancy began to leave Adam at home for varying stretches of time. Sometimes she would leave for the evening, sometimes a weekend trip, sometimes for a week. This was all, in her words, to teach him responsibility. Okay? He's going to be an adult. He needs to start doing things on his own, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Makes sense, I guess. With no one around to help occupy his time or encourage him to pursue other interests, Adam fell deeper into violent online gaming and his biggest passion, researching mass killers.
Back to what we talked about many times on this podcast, too, unrestricted access to the internet.
Yep. So, unknown to anyone close to him, particularly his mother, Adam was obsessing over mass killers throughout history. His interest first peaked in 2006 when he would follow online chat groups dedicated to mass killers, specifically Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold of the Columbine school shooting. This is when he began making up his top mass killers in history chart. Adam went as deep as listing the victims, what types of weapons they used, and he would constantly be updating this chart, placing these mass killers in order of number of kills.
The crazy part, too, about this is still going on today. I was telling Dave when I was kind of just looking online for Adam Lanza, because there's not a lot of information out there. It's really hard to kind of find it. And you can find subreddits and weird subreddits of kids that are doing the same thing to this day. And Adam Lanza is on that list now. So it's almost like
he's part of this. Now kids are looking at him as being
it's quote, actually unquote, a really hero. Fucking terrifying when you deep dive.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's like once you go into the Reddit, the subreddits and everything, there's like tons of information.
Yeah.
What's included in this story is what I could actually cross verify with other.
Yes, there's a lot of stuff that you're like, nah, it's you don't know if it's true or not, but
right.
But all I'm saying is that it's still going on today. So. Watch what your kids look like on the internet.
Yeah.
And a lot of older generations still to this day don't understand. I don't think they understand that it's not just social media that can, mess up your kid's psyche.
Right.
There's weird chats, weird subreddits, weird 4chan channels, anything.
Yeah, there's always like a little saying that I've always lived by as far as raising my kids. If your kids don't hate you at some point in their life, where you're even parenting them.
You're not doing a good enough job.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's okay. It's okay to piss your kids off. Like, you don't need the kid glow in their entire life. If they're spending too much time on the internet, find out what they're fucking looking at.
Yeah, if you didn't pack your shit up in a pillowcase and then tell your parents that you're moving away because you fucking hate them, then you're not, your parents aren't doing a good enough job. That should happen to at least once to you.
At least once. All right. So by 2009, Adam was no longer just a voyeur on these chat groups. He began actively participating. So much so, he had quite a few followers. It was around this time that Adam also began following websites and radio programs that advocated primitivist lifestyles. About a year before Lanza committed the murders, in December of 2011, he called into Anarchy Radio for a show hosted by one of his idols, a man by the name of John Zerzan, an anarchist and primitivist author who is critical of civil domestication and symbolic thought. Lanza called in to talk about Travis the Chimp and tried to correlate Travis's actions to those who commit mass shootings. Lanza uses the alias Greg in this call, and we'll discuss this more in a bit. But first, let's check out the clip.
Hello. We get the collapsible headphones here, but we're back.
Sorry, we got Greg on the phone.
Oh, Greg. Okay. How's it going?
Hi, good. I'm a fan of your writing.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to put up such an old news story, but I couldn't find anything that you said about the topic. And it seems relevant to your interest, so I thought I'd bring up Travis the Chimp. Do you remember him?
I don't.
Well, he was a highly domesticated chimpanzee who lived in a suburban home in Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And he was raised just like a human child, starting from the week he was born. By the time that he was 14 years old, which would be somewhere around age 20 in human years.
Uh-huh.
He slept in a bed, he took his own baths, he dressed himself, he brushed his teeth with an electric toothbrush.
Really? When was this?
Well, this happened in early 2009.
Oh.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
He ate his meals at a table and enjoyed human foods like ice cream. And he used a remote control to watch television and liked baseball games. And he even used a computer to look at pictures on the internet.
Huh.
And it goes without saying that Travis was very overweight. He was 200 pounds when he should have been around the low hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually taking Xanax.
Amazing.
I couldn't find any information about why he was taking it, but it just seems to say a lot.
To sedate him, he's a chimp. I know the story. This is like they actually had to give him Xanax to sedate him and not, because he would just have, because he's a fucking wild chimp.
Yeah.
And they needed to... He would get super excited or, like, you know, like, and just start destroying the fucking house.
That he was giving it at all. And basically, I think Travis wasn't really any different than a mentally handicapped human child.
Hmm.
But anyway, one day in February 2009, he was acting very agitated. And at some point, grabbed his owner's car keys, went outside and started leaping from car to car, apparently wanting to go for a car ride. And he was acting very aggressively, so his owner called her friend over to get her to help him to calm down and go back inside. And once she arrived, he immediately attacked her, and his owner tried to stop him, but couldn't, and she even resorted to stabbing him with a knife, but nothing worked. And she said that after she stabbed him, he looked at her as if to say, "Why'd you do that to me, Mom?" Because apparently that was what their relationship was like, no difference than between a human mother and a human child. After the stabbing, she called the police, who arrived 12 minutes after the attack.
So, just to go a little bit about Travis the Chimp and what he's talking about here. Now, the chimp attacked her, okay? What that means, the woman ended up surviving. She had to have total facial reconstruction. Yeah. He basically ripped the meat
off of her face.
Off of her face. Like, all of her fucking face.
Yep.
She now has one finger left. He basically bit off all of her fucking fingers.
Chimps are actually scary about... They actually go for... genitals,
yeah.
Fingers.
She was mutilated.
They understand what to, like, if you take off a hand, they can't eat or they can't grab, like, so they actually mutilate on purpose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fucking brutal.
Yeah, I've seen, you can see pictures of what she looks like now online. Must have been a fucking nightmare to be there that day.
We're talking years of fucking
skin grafts and,
like, facial reconstruction and, like, she lost her ears, like, her entire face. Like, you see, like cartoons where, you know, oh, somebody gets their face peeled off. You know?
Yeah.
It was like that.
Yeah.
It was her fucking skull,
was
basically.
Just left.
Yeah. It was bad. All right, back to the thing. Sorry.
At which point her friend was pretty close to dead. And once the cruiser came up, Travis went over to it, tried to open the locked passenger door. He smashed off the side view mirror, went over to the driver's door, opened it, and the cop shot him. He fled back into the house, where he went to his playroom and bled to death. And this might not seem very relevant, but I'm bringing it up because afterward, everyone was condemning his owner for saying how irresponsible she was for raising a chimp like it was a child, and that she should have known something like this would happen because chimps aren't supposed to be living in civilization. They're supposed to be living in the wild among each other. But their criticism stops there, and the implication is that there's no way anything could have gone wrong in his life if he had been living in civilization as a human rather than a chimp.
Ah, indeed.
So, isn't Travis, because he brings up questions
the
about
the foreshadowing in this is crazy.
Yeah.
It's eerie. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, he's trying to justify, or yeah. He's trying to correlate a chimp.
Of how he feels.
Yeah, to how you feel. Yeah, exactly.
It's creepy.
Like, you're trying to, like, civilize me. But can I really be civilized? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This whole process of child raising. Isn't something which just happens to gently exist without us having to do anything, because every newborn child, human child, is born in a chimp-like state, and civilization is only sustained by conditioning them for years on end, so that's still accepted for what it is. And since we've gone through this conditioning, we can observe a human family raising a human child, and I'm sure that even you have trouble intuitively seeing it as something unnatural. But when we see a chimp in that position, we visually know that there's something profoundly wrong with the situation. And it's easy to say there's something wrong with it simply because it's a chimp, but what's the real difference between us and our closest relatives? Travis wasn't an untamed monster at all. He wasn't just feigning domestication, he was civilized. He was able to integrate into society. He was a chimp actor when he was younger, and his owner drove him around the city frequently in association with her towing business, where he met many different people and got along with everyone. If Travis had been some nasty monster all his life, it would have been widely reported, but to the contrary, it seems like everyone who knew him said how shocked they were that Travis had been so savage, because they knew him as a sweet child. And there were two isolated incidents early in his life when he acted aggressively, but summarizing them would take too long, so basically I'll just say that he didn't act really any differently than a human child would, and the people who would use that as an indictment against having chimps live as humans do wouldn't apply the same thing to humans, so it's just kind of irrelevant. Look what civilization did to him. It had the same exact effect on him as it has on humans. He was profoundly sick in every sense of the term. Oh. And he had to resort to these surrogate activities like watching baseball and looking at pictures on a computer screen and taking Xanax. He was a complete mess. And his attack wasn't simply because he was a senselessly violent, impulsive chimp, which was how his behavior was universally portrayed. Immediately before his attack, he had desperately been wanting his owner to drive him somewhere. And the best reason I can think of for why he would want that, looking at his entire life, would be that some little thing he experienced was the last straw, and he was overwhelmed by the life that he had, and he wanted to get out of it by changing his environment, and the best way that he knew how to deal with that was by getting his owner to drive him somewhere else.
Yeah.
And when his owner's friend arrived, he knew that she was trying to coax him back into his life of domestication, and he couldn't handle that, so he attacked her and anyone else who approached him. And dismissing his attack as simply being the senseless, violent impulsiveness of a chimp instead of a human is wishful thinking at best. His attack can be seen entirely parallel to the attacks, random acts of violence that you bring up on your show every week. Committed by humans, which the mainstream also has no explanation for.
And no.
Actual human, I just don't think it would be such a stretch to say that he very well could have been a teenage mall shooter or something like that.
Yeah.
And
wow. Thank you, Greg.
Yeah.
That's quite a story. Yeah, that's really apropos, isn't it, Travis the Chimp?
It's just that I'm a little surprised that I never heard you bring it up at all, because maybe I'm just seeing connections where there aren't any, but...
I think not. No, I didn't catch that one. I didn't, maybe I was out of the country or something, I don't know, but I missed it. Thanks very much, man.
Thank you.
Take care. Wow, very well articulated.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Like, yeah. This kid was not...
So basically what he's saying is that if he was just a chimp in a chimp environment, this would have never happened.
Yeah, but, he's being forced.
But because he was conditioned a certain way, he didn't know how to instinctively react to or how to adapt, you know? So he's trying to correlate that with humans, where humans are conditioned to be a certain way, but some of them don't know how to correlate, you know what I mean?
He's Travis.
Yeah. So there was some discussion on whether or not Greg was actually Adam Lanza. The correlation was made when posts were discovered in a chat group called the Super Columbine Massacre RPG Discussion Forum, in which Lanza, this time using the screen name Smiggles, made comments referencing the radio show and Travis the Chimp on December 10th, 2011. First saying, "I should call into John Zerazan's radio program about Travis. I'm really surprised that I haven't been able to find anything he's written or said about the incident, considering how often he brings up random acts of violence. It seems Travis would be a poster chimp of that philosophy."
Yeah, and you can tell right by that statement that he's been in that forum talking about his ideas and all that stuff for a long time. That this has been a thread on that forum, on that chat room, for a long time.
Right.
So what, now go back, what else was said in there? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and after the call, on December 21st, 2011, Lanza, a.k.a. Smiggles, writes in the forum, "My call starts at 38 minutes. It didn't go as horribly as I anticipated. I wish I hadn't spoken nonstop about Travis for so long, but I didn't want to seem crazy by randomly bringing up a chimpanzee for unknown reasons. And despite my failed attempt at having a normal voice, I at least sounded less incoherent than usual. I normally speak much softer and swifter, with less articulation, less inflection, and more mumbling." So after reading all this stuff, I decided to dive a bit deeper into who John Zerzan was and what this dude was actually all about, and why Lanza was so fascinated with him. So Zerzan, as we stated, is an anarchist and a primitivist author. According to his Wikipedia page, his writings criticize agricultural civilization and domestication as inherently oppressive and advocates drawing upon the ways of life of the hunter and gatherers as an inspiration for what a free society should look like.
Yeah, humans were never supposed to settle down in one spot. We weren't supposed to create farms. We were supposed to move, and we're primitive animals.
Yeah.
Like, so there's a lot of people like that.
Yep.
It's the common day gym dude now.
Yeah.
I'm on an all meat diet.
Yeah.
Oh, dude. I don't eat wheat.
Yeah.
My ancestors didn't. I'm not going to eat. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're good. So once the belief is that once humans stopped foraging and following migration patterns for food and began domesticating plants and animals, we inherently began a cycle of violence, conquest, extermination, displacement, coerced and enslaved servitude, gender subordination, and sexual exploitation. I think I'm just going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say that all these things were present back then, too.
Before.
It's just human nature.
We're still wild fucking animals.
If you have one migrating family and another migrating family.
It was brutal.
Yeah, they probably were
fighting over the same fucking herd of buffalo or whatever.
Yeah, there was. I'm sure there was fucking violence and conquest and extermination back then, too. So whatever, dude. Anyway, so Zerzan also promotes the destruction of civilization, technology, and language, as they are the root to all of our societal and environmental problems. Zerzan is giving off some Unabomber vibes here, without the actual...
Incel vibes, too.
Bomber, yeah. All right, so how does this all relate to Lanza? So in the years leading up to Sandy Hook, Lanza became extremely withdrawn from society, up to and including isolating himself from his own brother and parents, as we discussed earlier. Zerzan spoke of a world where Lanza could freely be to himself and not have to obey to what society deems to be appropriate behaviors, as well as correlating the influx of mass shootings to being the result of those who had trouble adapting to and abiding by societal expectations, which is why Lanza felt it necessary to call in and share a story about Travis the Chimp and comparing that situation to why humans respond in a similar violent manner. Digging a bit deeper into some of the things that were shaping Lanza's outlook on society, I came across a site that alleged to have discovered Adam Lanza's unknown YouTube page, which was found under the name of Cultural Philistine. A YouTube search of this page came up empty, so I'm assuming it's been deleted since then. But I found...
which could actually make it more credible.
Yeah. But I have found audio recordings and transcripts from two separate sites. Links to these pages are listed under the sources section in the episode description. So go check that out. Now, keep in mind, I'm not totally sure of its authenticity, but I think it's at least worthy to bring up as we dive into Lanza's psyche leading up to the Sandy Hook massacre.
Yeah, it's just interesting how I mean, we'll probably discuss this later on the episode, but how like we were talking about earlier, this was kind of like it was such a tragic moment in American history that'll go down as the worst mass shooting, even though there's been more killings and more, you know what I mean? Yeah. It was shocking.
To date, it's the second worst.
Yeah. But it makes it
Virginia
even
Tech.
Correct. But it also the fact that it was kids under the age. It was the first one with kids that it like everybody like all the information, everything was shut up. We weren't allowed to talk about it. Yeah. You weren't allowed to bring up his name for the longest time. Mm. I mean, I don't know if we especially here in Connecticut, it was life felt like that. It felt like you weren't even allowed to say that guy's name.
Right.
And a lot of the information, video clips, it wasn't on the news. They didn't want to glorify this guy at all.
Yeah. Like even the news outlets around here, they had to like go to the Supreme Court to have some of this information released.
Yeah,
like, nobody was releasing anything.
Nope. You know? And that's why it's so hard to like link things. And
now I will say that there's about a 95% probability that these audio recordings are actually of Lanza because the cadence of his speech, the hard pronunciation of the letter T, if you notice in the last call, and the near monotone like telling of his stories seemed to be a perfect match with his known voice that we just heard on the radio call to Zerzan. Now, these recently discovered audio recordings consist of over 7 hours of Lanza discussing a variety of topics, from his disdain for cultural societies, absurdity of religion, life, suffering, suicide. He even goes into like 7 or 8 chapters of pedophilia and children to dissecting his own dreams, which I will note that consist of mostly of being in a school environment and him being surrounded by bullies, specifically from his childhood years. So he's breaking down all these dreams and they're basically all involving school situations. Now, we can date these audio recordings to at least September of 2010, 2 years prior to Sandy Hook, because he discusses the suicide death of Tyler Clementi, a student at Rutgers University who killed himself by jumping off the George Washington Bridge because his college roommate secretly live-streamed Clementi have a sexual relationship with another man. So I'll play the clip from one of these audio files in comparison to the radio call that we just heard, so you can kind of break down the similarities.
Figure out for yourself if you think it is or not.
Yeah, let us know if you think they're the same person. So here is the confirmed voice of Adam Lanza, again from the radio show. So we'll play a little clip here.
He was a highly domesticated chimpanzee who lived in a suburban home in Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And he was raised just like a human child, starting from the week he was born. By the time that he was 14 years old, which would be somewhere around age 20 in human years, he slept in a bed, he took his own baths, he dressed himself, he brushed his teeth with an electric toothbrush.
All right, so that's from the radio call, and then here's the voice from the audio recordings found on YouTube from the page Cultural Philistine.
A lot of the antinatalists disparage people for not being able to see the pointlessness of their existence. I'm actually closer to Graytex than I am to Gary. Strange as that may sound, considering.
Now, I just want to know, why did he use the name Gary in the radio call? He just brought up something, how he's closer to one thing other than Gary. I don't know who Gary is, but apparently Gary is a character or somebody who plays a role in his head.
Closer to Graytex than I am to Gary. Strange as that may sound, considering that I'm completely anti-life, I've always believed in personal meaning, whatever that means. It wasn't the realization that absolutely everything about me is a consequence of my environment that changed me. It was, well, I didn't really change that much. I've always been this way, but it was the realization that absolutely everything about me is not just personal meaning. It's that meaning itself is a scar. Basically everyone, whether or not they admit to it, think of life as being a tool that you can use to channel into some metaphysical plane of happiness. And that's why there are people who say, no matter how bad things get, at least I'm alive so that I can experience anything. But that's not how it is. Happiness and goodness and all of those synonymous words, they don't come from anywhere other than you. And by that, I don't mean to sound like Professor Anton saying that you should work toward those things. I'm actually saying the complete opposite. It's not that you build happiness and goodness out of nothing using suffering as some ingredient to somehow make it more grand. But what you create out of nothing is the suffering of not achieving what you want, not the happiness. There has never been a feral child who has said, sure, I like splashing in these ponds and climbing these trees, but I feel really bad about myself because I haven't written that book that I have been working on, and I haven't been to the symphony in a while, and I just feel so brutish and uncultured. Just like a disease, a feral child would need exposure to culture to experience the fulfillment of achieving any of those things. And all of that applies to feral desires, too. There's never been a rock that said, sure, I like being a rock, but I really would like to drink water. I mean, drinking is such a great experience. You can drink a gallon of water and could become completely disgusted by it. But if you go without drinking water for an entire day, of course, it's going to be one of the greatest experiences you've ever had. It's not because you're creating the happiness, it's because you're fulfilling the deprivation. And awareness itself is suffering. It's not that life has suffering. Life is suffering.
I hate how whenever you hear these manifestos and shit like this, and I hate how they try so hard to make a point to make them feel like they're doing something right. I hate that shit.
Yeah.
Because deep down, this is the biggest piece of shit in the world. And he's trying so hard to convince you of why this is why I am the way I am. Yeah. I hate that shit.
Society made it this way.
It's so fucking boo-hoo. Look at me.
Yeah.
And I...
Like this one, basically.
And that's another reason why kids get obsessed with this shit, because they take it and they're looking to find some sort of niche thing and to fit in how they feel, and they take those words and he's purposely doing it for that reason. Mm-hmm. It just makes me so mad.
Right. Yeah, because basically what he's saying here is, like, you know, happiness isn't really a real thing.
Yeah.
It's just something that you're fulfilling.
Yeah, it's been conditioned to be happy when you get water. Yeah. You know, like, right. Dude.
All right, so back to the comparison. I don't know. It seems like the same dude to me.
Oh, yeah. It's just,
go check out the link in the episode description.
Yeah, and for Claimer, we are not saying that this is him. This is not, we're
saying it.
We just found some stuff online that we're trying to show everybody.
Which quite possibly is probably him, but we're not saying it is him. So, but
and like, when you go look at the audio files, if you want to try to compare it and see, like, oh, is it him or not? Listen to the stuff on pedophile, the whole rants on pedophilia, because then you start to, it opens up a whole other can about why he chose children, and it gets there's a rabbit hole there.
We're not going to go out and give a motive.
Yes.
We have our opinions on it, but we're not going to explain what we think the motive is. Make your own opinions, whatever. But like Garrett said, listen to that 7-chapter series on pedophilia and children, and you might get an idea. All right, back to this. All right, so 2011 was the year Lanza would plummet into complete isolation. Basically, it was just him and his mother in this $1 million home, right? Lanza basically, from what I've read here, had the entire basement. That was his lair, his dungeon, and his mother, you know, would be upstairs, whatever. So he would tape off all the windows with black trash bags. He broke off all face-to-face contact with his mother.
I remember the news photos of his room.
Yeah.
It was fucking creepy. Minimalistic style. There was nothing, no color, no nothing.
Nothing. Just black trash bags.
Yeah, on the wall. And then a computer in the middle of the room with a chair. That's it.
Yeah, so he broke off all face-to-face contact with his mother, only communicating with Nancy through email, and refused to be in the same room as her on the rare occasion that he left his dungeon in the basement. He began to despise everything about people and life, even up to hating to eat food. It made him feel disgusting, and he hated the consistency of food. He just hated everything about it. during his autopsy, it was revealed that Adam Lanza was 6 feet tall and weighed only 112 pounds.
Jesus
He was
Christ.
Emaciated. Now, according to
Well, you know what? I mean, anybody who has bipolar friends or family members understands that the first, like, clue that someone's going into a manic episode is they stop eating and they stop sleeping. So right there should show you, hey, maybe I should get my child some fucking help.
Right. Yep. According to the National Library of Medicine, there is a link between eating disorders and psychosis.
Yeah, exactly what I just said.
Yeah. So take that how you will. Now, in the months leading up to December 14th, 2012, Nancy was telling friends and family that she intended to sell their house and move to an area where Adam could thrive once again, possibly Washington State or California. Unknown to most people, Nancy had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and felt that her time was running out to effectively provide Adam a life where he could maintain on his own. She felt a new scenery would do them both good. Adam at first entertained the idea, but soon didn't want to leave the isolated world that he had created, and this added to his self-induced separation from Nancy. There was also the falling out he had with a friend in June of 2012. This was a friend that Adam had known since attending Sandy Hook Elementary School. It is believed that this friend was also diagnosed with ASD. They would always play online games together and would meet in person a few times every month, either at the arcade or the movies, as they both shared an interest in Dance Dance Revolution and horror movies. They would also share a morbid fascination with mass killers and serial killers. The friend, not as in-depth as Lanza, but it was a shared interest.
You know? Yikes.
Kind of what we do here on the show.
Yeah. You know?
I'm a little bit more involved than you are, but...
Yeah. Yikes.
So in June of 2012, Lanza and the friend had a falling out over a movie, and they never spoke again. It's unclear if this was mutual or if Lanza was the one who cut off the communication.
Well, I mean,
I'm going to say it was Lanza.
It was Lanza, because if you can cut your brother, your dad, your mom out of your life, you can easily cut a friend out.
Yep. So all of this was over a disagreement over a movie. Criminal AF would be back after this quick break. Now back to Criminal AF. So by the end of 2012, Lanza had no support system whatsoever. He was lost in whatever warped world he had created for himself. On Tuesday, December 11th, 2012, Nancy once again left Adam alone as she traveled to New Hampshire. As reported by the New York Post, Nancy Lanza checked into the Omni Mount Washington Resort around noon on that day, the 11th, which meant she left Connecticut around 7:30 in the morning. She checked out on December 13th, around the same time, and made the trip back to Connecticut. During this time, Adam was putting together the final pieces of his plan. No one will ever know what this plan really consisted of or why he chose to do what he did, because he destroyed his computer and hard drive. Authorities were able to recover some of the contents, but nothing that directly relates to the actions of December 14th. What is known is that while Nancy was gone, Lanza had driven from his home to Sandy Hook Elementary School without actually pulling into the parking lot, and then drove back home, assuming he was timing the trip or whatever. But he did make a pre-trip to the elementary school. Now, later that afternoon into the early evening of the 13th, Nancy arrived home. There was no communication between her and Adam when she finally arrived home. He had, you know, at this point completely cut her off. You know, there was basically no communication whatsoever. Now, from here on out, a complete timeline is hard to make out. Other than a few known facts, the actions of Adam Lanza are alleged. It's assumed that Adam and Nancy stayed separated with no contact throughout the night. Between the hours of 9 a.m. and 9:25 a.m. on December 14th, 2012, Adam Lanza, dressed in all black clothing, black shoes, black hat, and an olive green military-style utility vest, walked into Nancy's bedroom. While she was still sleeping, he pointed her .22 LR Savage Mark II bolt-action rifle at her head and fired 4 times, killing her instantly. Nobody knows why he fired 4 times exactly, but his father, Peter Lanza, suspects that he did it because it was 1 bullet for each member of his family.
Ooh, that's a good correlation. Mm-hmm.
So 1 bullet for mom, 1 bullet for dad, 1 bullet for Ryan, and 1 for himself. Lanza then threw the gun to the floor and loaded his mother's car with a 12-gauge shotgun, a Glock 20 SF handgun, a Sig Sauer P226 handgun, and a Bushmaster XM15 and several hundred rounds of ammunition. He then drove off for the 5-mile drive to Sandy Hook Elementary School. By the time he arrived, the school had just locked its doors to visitors. Now, this is common for many schools. Like, once the school day begins, like, all the buses arrive, parents drop off their kids, blah, blah, blah. They lock up the doors, and the only way in and out of the school is to get buzzed in.
This shooting changed so much.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I'm not even, like, I mean, anyone who has kids understands this. You're not even allowed to go into the school when you go and pick up your kids.
Yeah.
They come out to you with a sign-out sheet. They check your verification.
Yeah.
And then they go back in. They say, okay, she'll be out in a little bit.
Yep.
They don't even let parents in the fucking school. Really? During
it's
the
been
day.
A hot minute since my kids have been in school.
Dude, it's but crazy.
I remember.
I mean, anybody who has young kids now understands how it is. Like,
I remember after this, like, actually, like, I was very.
Oh, wait, yeah, your kids were in school at that point. I couldn't even imagine.
I was very involved with my kids' schools. I did the field trips. I did in-school, like, help, you know, teacher helper kind of things. They used to have. Even parents could sign up for as teacher helpers. I did all that shit, you know, with my kids. So they knew, like, the office knew who I was.
Yeah.
Right? After this, I still had to buzz the buzzer, hold up my ID to the camera.
Yep.
So they could verify that I was who I was, even though they knew me extremely well.
Yep.
You know, like I said, I was a coach. I coached school basketball for the kids. I did the youth football thing.
Active.
Yeah, active in my kids' schooling. And, yeah, I still had to go through all that. Like, they would not buzz you in until you showed a verifiable government ID. You know what I mean? It was crazy. All right, so yeah. So at this time, Lanza parked his car and popped the trunk to grab the two pistols and the Bushmaster XM15. Now, no one knows why he left the 12-gauge shotgun and the 70 rounds of shotgun shells behind. Now, as bad as this day is about to turn out, it could have been a lot worse if he had taken the shotgun. You know, everybody likes to jump on the AR-15 hype. Oh, you're like, oh, you know, it's deadly. But for close quarters,
oh, dude,
a shotgun does a lot more damage.
That it would have been. I mean, it's already, like you said, it's you're not taking the actions of that day lightly. Yeah. But 100%, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
It's good thing that he left that shotgun in that.
Yeah. It would have been a million times.
I mean, we've said it in the podcast, me and Dave both work with firearms on a daily basis. We understand them.
Yeah.
A shotgun would not have been.
Yeah. No, obviously an AR-15 does a lot more damage than a pistol.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The higher caliber bullet. There were, I believe, 4 victims that were wounded. They did survive, but they were wounded.
Yep.
If this was a shotgun, they would be dead.
Yeah.
There's no wounded. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So I'll just leave it at that. All right. Now, when Lanza approaches the door and discovers that it's locked, he starts shooting out the window to gain access to the school. School announcements were just being read as the shooting occurred, and the PA system was left on, so all the classrooms throughout the school could hear what was happening in the moment.
Oh, my God.
So this moment is actually helped save a large number of lives that day. More on this in a second. Now, just outside the main office, the next room over, is a conference room. And inside the conference room, Principal Dawn Hotsprung and school psychologist Mary Sherlock were meeting with faculty members when they heard the loud noises. Like, they weren't sure what was... It sounded like clapping. They did not immediately determine the noises were coming from a rifle. Again, the PA is on, so people are hearing these noises as well. So Hotsprung and Sherlock and a teacher named Natalie Hammond all raced out into the hallway to see what the noise was. The three women instantly yelled out, "Shooter!" which could be heard over the PA system. Sadly, they can also hear what happened next. Janitor Rick Thorne yelled out, "Put the gun down!" and was able to flee amongst the hail of bullets. Lanza opened fire and killed Principal Dawn Hatsprung and school psychologist Mary Sherlock instantly. Teacher Natalie Hammond was struck in the leg and then shot a second time. She lay still in the hallway until she knew the gunman moved on. She crawled her way back into the conference room and then bracing herself against the door so they couldn't come in. She did survive the attack. The first 911 call came in at 9:35 a.m. and then 30 seconds after they heard the first shots. Lanza then entered the main office. Now, by this time, everyone within the office was either hiding or had fled the office. The school nurse hiding under a desk later reported that she saw Lanza walk in and scan the office. He stood there for a few seconds and then exited. Now, while he's standing in there for a few seconds, this is when Hammond, the teacher Hammond, crawled her way back in. So he leaves the office and Lanza walks down the hallway, skipping classroom 12, which was the first classroom on the left. Luckily for the teacher, Caitlin Roig, and I apologize if I'm butchering these names, and the children inside the classroom, Roig had forgotten to remove the black construction paper from the glass on her classroom door from a recent active shooter drill just a week before.
Jesus.
It's believed that Lanza may have thought that the classroom was dark and empty as he passed. There was nobody in the classroom. So he just walked right past. This is another moment where the timelines become kind of cloudy. Lanza did, for a fact, enter two classrooms, classrooms 10 and classroom 8. The information that I found stated that these sequence of events were indeterminate. So they're not sure exactly how this next part of the story happened.
Yeah.
But we'll go with the most discussed sequence in which Lanza, he skips classroom 12, he bypasses classroom 10, and enters classroom 8. Lanza forces his way into classroom 8, which is the classroom of Lauren Russo, a 30-year-old substitute teacher. Lauren, along with 29-year-old Rachel DeVino, a behavioral therapist, had quickly gathered the class and led them to the bathroom. Lanza entered the bathroom and opened fire. Lauren, Rachel, who had just started at the school the week before, and 14 first graders were found dead, each of them with multiple gunshot wounds. So each child was shot multiple times.
Oof.
Another student was found in critical condition, but later died at the hospital. There was one student, a 6-year-old girl, who survived. Oh, I just need a moment. Holy shit. There was one student, a 6-year-old girl, who survived the shooting in classroom 8. She was found hiding in the corner of the bathroom and played dead in order to survive. Later, she was quoted as saying, "Mommy, I'm fine, but my friends are dead."
Yeah, I remember that. That was terrible.
Yeah. All right. So Lanza moved back, moved out of classroom 8, where there was only one survivor, and went back to classroom 10. Inside, there was 27-year-old teacher Victoria Soto, who had moved her first graders to the back of the room. Some of the students entered the bathroom. Just so we can paint a picture here, each classroom had their own bathroom.
Bathrooms, yeah.
Some entered the bathroom, some huddled in the back corner of the room, and some were hiding under their desks. She was making her way back to the door to lock it when Lanza entered. Victoria told him that the kids were in a gymnasium. According to this report, for one reason or another, some of the kids moved out of their hiding spots to make a run for it, and Lanza opened fire. Victoria placed herself between the children and Lanza, and she was killed. Special education teacher, 52-year-old Anna Marie Murphy, was also found dead in classroom 10. She was found covering the body of one of her students, who was also deceased. There was a pause in the shooting in classroom 10. Either Lanza had a jam or he was switching magazines. But a report states that first grader Jesse Lewis jumped up during this pause and yelled to his classmates to make a run for it. Within seconds, Lanza was back to shooting, and he killed Jesse, but not before Jesse had saved several of his classmates.
Wow.
God damn, I need a minute. Holy fuck.
Yeah, dude.
All right. And all, Victoria...
The balls on that little kid.
Yeah. And Six years old.
To make that call?
6 years old.
To make that call is crazy.
Yep. In all, Victoria, Anne, and 4 children were found dead in classroom 10. 9 children had escaped, and 2 were found still hiding in the bathroom. One student from classroom 10 was rushed to the hospital, but later died. After the initial 911 call at 9:35 a.m., 3 police officers were on scene at Sandy Hook by 9:39 a.m. Shortly after, at 9:40, the last shot was heard coming from the school. This was the shot that Adam Lanza took to end his own life. By 9:44 a.m., police were already in the building clearing children out of school. Swift action by the Newtown Police and Connecticut State Police, unlike the Nimrods at Uvalde.
I was about to say, don't even get me started about that.
Who, you know, they took almost an hour and a half to clear the room, and they're standing with their thumbs up their ass. There's video of one cop scrolling through his fucking Facebook or whatever on the phone.
Yep.
Another one going over and sanitizing his hands, making sure his hands were fucking clean, all while this fucking shooter is still in the room. But that's a totally different story.
Yeah.
We actually did a YouTube and chill on that, if anybody's interested in watching it. All right. So from 9:35 to 9:40, there were 156 shots fired. 154 from the Bushmaster XM-15 and two from the Glock 20 SF, with one bullet being fired down a hallway and the second being fired into Lance's stupid, shrunken fucking head. The 12-gauge and the 6-Sauer P226 were never fired. Now, while there never may be a motive to help explain what could have gone wrong and what could have been done to prevent it, there are a couple of theories. Lanza's obsession with violent video games, mass killers, coupled with his life increasingly becoming more destitute and possible psychosis from his anorexia. As we stated, Lanza was just 112 pounds at 6 feet tall. I don't even think my leg weighs a fucking 112 pounds. You know what I mean? It's like...
Yeah, I feel like it's a cop-out to say violent video games, though.
Yeah.
I think it more of that comes down to just his deep obsession with dark shit and going on the internet and chatting with like-minded people.
Yeah.
And kind of getting this weird internet fame by his constituents in those chat rooms.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, that definitely was a...
I think it's very easy for the media at that time to blame... Yeah. Video games.
Mm-hmm. Now, some have speculated that Lanza may have been in his own version of a video game, as he was witnessed changing magazines well before they were empty, as you would do in a video game like Call of Duty or something. I've watched my kids play Call of Duty, and they're like every like fucking 3 seconds they're changing
tactical reloads.
Yeah,
yeah. It's also trained.
We do. Yeah, we do it too. Yeah,
yeah. You're also trained that in certain situations if you work with firearms.
Yeah. As far as how this could have been prevented, I personally, this is my own personal opinion, I would say consistency and acceptance from Nancy Lanza could have gone a long way. You know, it's been reported that Nancy was very hesitant to accept that her son had Asperger's, autism.
That is such a strong statement. Like early prevention is the key in that situation. 100%. And you hear all these stories, and I've seen it personally, of people that won't claim that their kids have something wrong.
Yeah.
Because not my baby.
Yep. Nothing wrong with my kid.
With my kid. And doctors have come out and said that early prevention cures everything. And I think she ran out of options with him too. And I think she kind of gave up and you know, you can't put yourself in those shoes until you're there, right? So you don't know. You can't say, "Oh, I would have did this differently," because if you've never experienced this, you don't know. But I mean, I feel like it comes down to her just giving up and letting him fall down that hole.
Yeah. She told her friends and family that Adam was just quirky and he was an idiot savant. He was a genius, and he just, you know, he wasn't like the other kids. You know,
it's probably very hard to. And you, as a parent, right, you come home, and this kid was clearly very eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
He was probably incredibly smart. He probably had detailed like conversations about, you know, politics and the world around you. And when you're sitting here having conversations with your young son about these things, autism kind of goes out the window at that point. You're like, wow, this kid's very smart. He's eloquent. So it's probably like she said, he's quirky, but you know, he's.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with him.
He's just, you know, he's just a little weird, just a little offset. So I think that adds to it when a kid is that smart, and you're like, oh, he doesn't need help. He's smart. He's a smart boy.
Now, also throughout the years of his schooling, there was no consistency. She was continually removing him from schools just to enroll him again, over and over and over and over.
Stay home. Go here. Yeah. Do this. So
by doing this, she never let his IEP truly work, you know, like the IEP that they set in schools. It said that she blamed the schools for her son's problems rather than accepting that he needed intensive supports and counseling.
Yeah.
There are no records whatsoever available that show Lanza received any therapy or counseling after 2008.
That's a statement.
Yeah. And then, as we discussed in the story, after 2008 was when the most major life events occurred, like his favorite teacher leaving the school, his parents divorcing, his all that kind of stuff. He needed serious help during these years. You know what I mean? It was imperative. But instead, she left him to his own vices, his obsession with violence and murder, which eventually consumed much of his life, that he possibly couldn't tell between fantasy and reality.
Yeah, I feel like there's a strong hate of people in general.
Mm-hmm. And I'll say this again. What parent lets their 6-foot kid start weighing 112 pounds?
That goes back to what I was saying. She just gave up.
Do you fucking step in? Like, why aren't you stepping in? And I'm not putting this all on her, you know.
No, but, yeah. He's still to blame for everything that he's done.
I'm also putting it on the father too.
Yeah.
Because the father,
knowing
like all this shit was fucking going on, knowing that his kid wrote a fucking book about Granny fucking massacring people, knowing all this shit, when his son,
my problem anymore.
Oh, Adam just he stopped talking to me. I mean, he did make some efforts to maintain communication, but Adam was just like, nope, I'm done. And he basically, like, said, I left all the raising of the children to Nancy. Yep. You know, he was very hands-off, whatever.
1950s dad.
Yeah. So, now, another possible red flag was putting a live weapon into the hands of an obviously disturbed individual is a recipe for disaster. Yeah,
giving access to, to be able to know the safe combo, or even if he didn't know the safe, did he know the safe combination? I think he did, right? If he didn't know, then it was still unopened.
Right.
It was still, it wasn't locked.
And you know, his mother, oh, he's so responsible. He takes great care of the weapons. You know, she's telling her friends, the dude was literally probably jizzing in his pants.
Yeah, he was obsessed.
You know what I mean? He's like, holy shit, this is what I could use in real life. Well, you know, of course he's going to be like, it's like, you know, I can compare this to, the 68 Camaro my dad rebuilt. You know, the first time I drove it, I was in awe. I'm like, whoa, I'm like following all the traffic rules. I'm doing the speed limit. I'm like, holy shit, a 68 fucking Camaro. Well, guess what happened the second time I took it out? I'm fucking pulling whole shots. I'm fucking
like, chirping fucking gears.
Let's see what this motherfucker cut. Yeah. So will I say that this was 100% preventable? I personally, now this opinion is not reflective of anybody associated with this show. This is just my opinion.
Yep.
It was 100% preventable. And I understand that people are going to get pissed at me for placing blame on a victim, his mother, because in reality, she was Adam's first victim. And there are numerous reports of how she was a wonderful lady. She was always willing to help anyone in need, you know, which is great and commendable, but she didn't help the one person who truly needed it, which was her own son.
Who needed her.
Yeah. And she paid the price for it, which is sad. But anyway, enough about Skeletor.
I love that.
It's time
fuck to that piece of shit. Yeah, you can call it whatever you want. Skeletor is great.
Yeah. It's time to put the focus on the real heroes and angels of this story.
Yes.
The 26 beautiful lives that were taken way too soon. We're going to start with Charlotte Bacon, age 6. Charlotte was sweet, outgoing, and full of energy. Her hair was a mass of beautiful red curls. Daniel Barden, age 7. His family stated that Daniel earned his missing front teeth from his fearless pursuit of happiness, which also earned him ripped jeans.
Oh, man.
Olivia Engel, age 6. Olivia's favorite stuffed animal was a lamb. Her favorite colors were pink and purple. She took art and dance lessons, as well as played tennis and soccer. Josephine Gay, age 7. Josephine, whose favorite color was purple, had just celebrated her birthday just a few days before she passed. She loved to ride her bike and sell lemonade in her neighborhood during the summer. Dylan Hockley, age 6. Dylan and his family had moved to Connecticut from England just 2 years before he died. He loved to cuddle with his parents and play tag with the other kids at his bus stop. Madeline Hsu, age 6. Sweet, unique, bright, and sparkling are just a few words to describe Madeline, who is also an accomplished reader for her age, and she loved running and dancing. Catherine Hubbard, age 6. This little girl with bright red hair will be remembered for her infectious smile and her love of all animals. Chase Kowalski, age 7. In his young life, Chase had already competed in his first triathlon. I'm 50 and I haven't even done one. I haven't even attempted. Chase loved baseball, Cub Scouts, and he loved the kids' workshop at Home Depot. Jesse Lewis, age 6. Now, Jesse, I believe this is the boy that yelled to his classmates to run, 6 years old. Jesse loved math, riding horses, and playing at the farm. He was really looking forward to building gingerbread houses for Christmas. Anna Marquez Green, age 6. Anna was a beautiful and vibrant little girl with pigtails. She loved to sing and listen to her brother play piano. James Mattioli, age 6. James loved to wear shorts and t-shirts in any weather. It would sing at the top of his lungs. He was born 4 weeks premature because his family said he was hungry.
That's funny. Yeah. There's always that one kid that wears shorts and t-shirts. All year round.
Yep. Grace McDonald, age 7. Grace loved her family, especially her brother, school, the beach, and aspired to one day become a painter. Emily Parker, age 6. Emily never missed an opportunity to draw someone a picture or make them a card. She was bright, creative, and very loving with an infectious laugh. Jack Pinto, age 6. Jack was a football fanatic, with his favorite team being the New York Giants. His other loves were baseball, basketball, and wrestling. He competed in his very first wrestling match a few days before his murder, and he took home a medal. Way to go, Jack. Good job. Noah Posner, age 6. Noah had a huge heart. He was so much fun to be around, a little rambunctious with a lot of spirit. He was also an ace with Lego. He loved building Legos. Carolyn Praviti, age 6. She was described as a sweet little angel. Jessica Ricos, age 6. Jessica loved everything to do with horses. Everything with horses. Horse movies, horse books, horse drawings, and writing stories about horses. Santa was even bringing her new cowgirl boots and a cowgirl hat for Christmas. Aviel Richmond, age 6. Another horse lover. Aviel was happiest when she was riding her horse. Benjamin Wheeler, age 6. Benjamin loved the Beatles, lighthouses, and the number 7 train to Sunnyside, Queens. Allison Wyatt, age 6. Allison was a sweet, creative, funny, and intelligent little girl. She was very kind-hearted. She would offer strangers snacks on the airplane. And now the teachers. Rachel DeVino, age 29. Rachel didn't know this at the time of her death, but her boyfriend was about to propose. He had just asked her parents for their blessing and was preparing to drop to one knee on Christmas Eve. Dawn Hochsprung, age 47. Dawn, who had become Sandy Hook's principal just 2 years before, was described as really nice and very funny. Anne Marie Murphy, age 52. Anne was a happy soul who died what she loved doing, serving children. Lauren Russo, age 30. Lauren wanted to be a teacher from before she was even in kindergarten. After teaching stints in Danbury and New Milford, Lauren was hired as a full-time substitute teacher just a month before the tragedy. Mary Sherlock, age 56. Mary loved gardening, reading, going to the theater, and of course, helping her students. Victoria Soto, age 27. Victoria had wanted to be a teacher all of her life and literally gave her life for her students. Soto left behind the love of her life, a black lab named Roxy.
Wow, dude. Yeah. You just kept going with those fucking 6 and 7 year olds, and that really got me.
Yeah.
Because they're my kids' age. So.
Yeah. Yep.
I couldn't imagine sending my kids to school and not them never coming home.
Yep. All right. So that'll do it for this episode of the Sandy Hook Massacre by Criminal AF. Thank you all for hanging out with us. So please take a moment to go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a review or comment on the episode. And don't forget, head on over to criminalasfuck.com for all of your Criminal AF needs, socials, Patreon, merch store. Submit your mail call questions, you name it, it's there. Now, signing off from Studio Chloroform, keep your head on a swivel and stay safe till next time.
See ya!